And welcome back to Cool Science Radio. JW here with Lynn Ware Peake. Lynn, I was looking at the New York Times yesterday, the science and technology section, and they had an article that I started reading about the liver. And what it turns out to be, it's like a love letter to the liver. First of all, a little historical backstory. The Mesopotamians, the liver was the body's premier organ, the seat of human soul and emotions. The ancient Greeks linked the liver to pleasure, and the Elizabethans referred to their monarch not as the head of state, but as the head of liver. Anyway, the liver does a bunch of things. They say it's second only to the brain, numbers well over 300 items that it does, including reworking all the food we eat to usable building blocks for our cells, neutralizing many potential harmful substances that we incidentally or deliberately ingest. It's also responsible for generating a pharmacopoeia, I can't even pronounce that word, of hormones, enzymes, clotting factors, and immune molecules. I could go on for 20 minutes on all the things they listed about the liver.
Well, isn't it funny, John, that we take our organs for granted, right? Who even ponders our organs? But when we do, it turns out that the liver is really it's the most fascinating organ. It performs more feats of endurance, and more utilities than any other organ. So, for example, if you do ponder the liver,
I do.
You find
now
after this article, you find that, you know, if your lungs fail, they have mechanical ventilators to breathe for you. Of course, we know about dialysis if your kidneys fail, and the heart, since it's just a pump, you know, they have an artificial one that they can throw in there. But we have, as it turns out, nothing artificial, no replacement for the liver if it fails, which I guess, you know, if I had thought about that very long, I would have known that. But again, not pondering the liver until now.
Yeah.
It's pretty fascinating.
And then something else I learned, which was it's completely different, but researchers were astonished to discover that the liver grows and shrinks by up to 40% every 24 hours, while all the other organs around it do not budge.
Yeah. And how about this? 13% of our body's blood supply is held in the liver at any given time. 13% of our blood. I had no idea.
You're listening to The Liver Show on Cool Science Radio. Hey, our first guest is on the phone, so we're going to give him a little intro, introduce him, and start our conversation with him. Our first guest, Mark O'Connell. He's written The Close Encounters Man, How One Man Made the World Believe in UFOs. The book's about Dr. J. Allen Hynek, the first astronomer to be recruited by the U.S. Air Force in order to debunk UFO sightings, but only to eventually believe in them and establish their scientific validity. Mark O'Connell, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Thank you. It's great to be here today.
Well, it's good to have you here. You know, we've all seen these pictures of cave drawings and pictographs from all these different ancient cultures of chariots of fire descending from our sky. But tell us about the last 80 years. How did the modern-day fascination with UFOs begin?
That's such a great question. There were some rumblings during World War II. You may have heard of Foo Fighters, which were strange lights that would appear along the wingtips of World War II fighter planes and freak out the pilots. There were also things called ghost rockets in the Scandinavian countries in the 40s. But it really hit home exactly 70 years ago this month. A private pilot named Kenneth Arnold was flying his plane in the Pacific Northwest, and he saw a chain of 9 silvery objects flying through the sky at about what he clocked at 1,200 miles an hour. And that was the first modern UFO sighting, and it became national news. The pilot became a huge celebrity, and as soon as his report became news, all sorts of people came out of the woodwork and started reporting their UFO experiences. And all of these reports were being funneled to the U.S. Air Force, and the U.S. Air Force had no idea what to do about this. It quickly became a huge, huge embarrassment for the Air Force because they weren't able to do their job. Here were these strange objects invading our airspace, and the Air Force was apparently completely powerless to stop this from happening or even to explain what was happening. So this is where Dr. Hynek enters the picture. He was a college astronomy professor, and the Air Force brought him in to debunk these UFO reports. Hynek's job was to look at each report and decide whether the object in question was simply a misidentification of an astronomical object. And he was very, very good at this, and he was able to explain away about 80% of the flying saucer reports. It was that 20% that couldn't be explained that became the issue.
Well, you know, we did some research on you and found that you had written some award-winning screenplays for Star Trek Next Generation. And when I picked up your book and I just read the first two sentences of the prologue, I figured out right away, yeah, this guy knows how to write. I just want to read the first two sentences. We didn't always put our dead aliens on ice or pickle them in jars. We used to give them proper burials. Take us back to 1897 in Aurora, Texas.
Oh, that's a fun chapter in UFO history. Yeah, late 1890s, these mysterious self-propelled airships started to appear all over North America, generally appearing over large cities where they would be guaranteed of attracting huge crowds. They were lighter than air. Well, I shouldn't say they were actually heavier than air, but they could float through the air and they could move into the wind, and they could project really brilliant electrical light beams. None of this had ever been seen before. There was, of course, a huge fascination with the development of flight around this time, but nobody had ever actually succeeded. And now here there are these gigantic airships appearing in the sky over American cities like crazy in 1897. And yeah, one appeared over the little town of Aurora, Texas. And according to the story, the flying ship crashed in town and actually struck a windmill and exploded. And there was debris scattered all over town. And it was reported in a Dallas newspaper about 2 days after it happened. And the most curious part of that whole story is that there were the remains of the pilot of the airship were recovered among the wreckage, and he was described as a grotesque being that could only be a Martian. So that's one of the big sort of bellwether moments in history where the idea of invading Martians really began to take hold in the public subconscious.
And they gave him a proper burial in the town cemetery.
Yes, they did. He was buried in the town cemetery, and for all anybody knows, he's still there. People have tried to exhume the body, but they have always been blocked by court orders or law enforcement or sometimes just armed citizens who just sort of show up and block the gates to the cemetery because they don't want anybody digging this guy up.
Which might suggest to those who are believers that it's because his skeletal structure is that of certainly not a human who lives on Earth, right?
Oh, yeah, yeah. That's definitely the thinking.
So the military hires Dr. Joseph Allen Hynek, and they hire him, and you said, I forget your exact wording now, but to debunk, essentially, all of these UFO sightings. But then you also say to decide whether they were real or not. So he debunks about 80% of them. The other 20% are the things that eventually turns him from a debunker into a believer. And I just have to ask you, as you researched for this book, Mark, what did it do for you?
Oh,
in terms of, you know, debunker to believer.
She asks me hard questions all the time, Mark.
I was already a believer, so I started off from a much different place than Dr. Hynek had in the late 1940s. So I didn't really have too far to go, but I did find that I was swayed a great deal by Dr. Hynek's approach to the study of UFOs. He was always reluctant to take a firm stand on what they were. He never committed to the extraterrestrial hypothesis. He was open to multiple different explanations of what could be going on. I found that very impressive, and I've tried to take that into account in my thinking. I've also, here's a minor part of the story that had a big effect on me. When I started looking through Hynek's personal professional files at Northwestern University in their archives, I came across dozens and dozens and dozens of letters written to Dr. Hynek from people all over the world who would say, I want to tell you about my UFO experience. And then they would go on for 10 or 20 pages describing their UFO experience. Or they'd say, I want to tell you about my new theory of reality. And then they'd go on for 10 or 20 pages. And I would look at these letters and think, oh, my God, I don't know how I would respond to this. Mm-hmm. But you get into his files and you see these responses that he would write to people. And he basically felt like, look, if you have an idea to share, then you deserve to be heard. And so he would read these letters and he would send back 10 or 20 page responses going over point by point. Well, now here's where I agree with you. Here's where I disagree with you. And I was so struck by the fact that he was willing to give so much time and attention to people who had just all variety of beliefs about UFOs. I was so impressed with that, with his attitude to that, that I tried to bring that attitude to my research and my writing of the book. Mm. Anybody who's got a story to tell about this phenomenon deserves to be heard.
Yeah. Well, you know, let's talk a little bit of what seems to me a preponderance of stories about UFO sightings during the, you know, the late 40s, the 50s. Now, we don't, at least, I don't find that we're seeing a lot of UFOs. Is it that we now explain everything away to ourselves as, oh, that's a satellite or that's some kind of spacecraft? Whereas back then, we just, I don't know, we were more creative in our thinking or more willing to believe?
Mm-hmm. I think that's an interesting point. And one of the things that struck me in my research was I had to sort of readjust my mindset and put myself in the shoes of somebody in 1947 or 1948 who saw something strange in the sky and realized this is a person who has never seen a rocket launch, either live or on TV news. This is a person who has never seen a jet airplane. These are technologies that they were known at the time, they were in development at the time, but nobody had seen them. So I tried to put myself in that mindset of, okay, if I had never seen these things and I saw something strange in the sky, how would I interpret it? How would I describe it? And that's always a stumbling block because, of course, nobody knows how to describe it. Hynek would always point out, look, these people are trying to describe something using a vocabulary that simply doesn't exist. So, you know, these are the stumbling blocks to understanding the phenomenon. But I definitely think that if you can try to put yourself in the shoes of someone who's seen these things in different times and just see it through their frame of reference, it does help to understand what the phenomenon represents, what it means.
If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we're having a conversation with Mark O'Connell. He's written a fascinating book, The Close Encounters Man, How One Man Made the World Believe in UFOs. Well, we are in Park City, Utah here this morning, and so let's bring this back to Utah, to Tremonton, Utah in July of 1952, yeah. And we'll also bring in, of course, Hill Air Force Base in Ogden, Utah. There is 50 feet of film that defied all experts and possibly brought Hynek to the other side. Tell us about that.
It is such a good story, and it's really, for me, one of the most convincing UFO stories out there. A family out on vacation, driving near Tremonton, Utah. They're out on a lonely highway, as so often happens in UFO reports. And the wife looks out the window of the car and says, hey, what's that in the sky? There are 15 or 20 bright balls of light sort of cavorting about in the blue sky. And the husband sees it and pulls over to the side of the road. And the husband turns out to be a Navy photographer who has thousands of hours of flight time. So this is a guy who understands how flying machines work, and he also understands how light works because of his photography work. So he gets his Bell and Howell movie camera out of the trunk of the car and starts filming these objects in the sky. And when you watch the movie, and you can find it anywhere online, you can find it on YouTube and all sorts of places. When you watch this film and you start to sort of see how these objects move about, at first it seems kind of random, but after a few seconds it sort of seems a little rhythmic, a little cyclical. these objects are sort of grouping together and then moving apart. And so the Navy photographer gets this film developed and sends it up the chain of command. And it winds up being reported to Project Blue Book, the Air Force project that Hynek worked for. But more importantly, it ends up being analyzed by our country's best photo analysts. These are the people who confirmed to JFK during the Cuban Missile Crisis that, yes, there are nuclear missiles in Cuba, you know, based on satellite photographs. So these are people who really know their way around photographic images. And they put thousands of man hours into analyzing this short movie film, and they come to the conclusion that these objects are not birds, they are not airplanes, they are not balloons. They are light-emitting objects of unknown origin, and we really need to take a closer look at this. So it's just fascinating that we have this movie film that, in my opinion, is pretty strong evidence that there is something very strange going on in the sky. And, of course, it ended up, you know, the last scene of Raiders in the Lost Ark where the Ark ends up being stored in this gigantic warehouse.
Oh, yeah.
Full of all sorts of crates, you know, endless rows of crates. That's kind of what happened to that movie film. It's just sort of, you know, it was in the possession of the Army or the Air Force, and it's just kind of, I don't know if anyone knows where the original version is, but it sure would be nice to find, because I would like to have my dream UFO investigation would be to hire the best special effects wizards in the film industry and have them analyze this film, not just frame by frame, but pixel by pixel, and really try to determine exactly what is being seen in that film.
So Ogden, Utah, July 1952, was that 50 feet of film turned Hynek. Is there any one piece of evidence or story that has that convinced you to come to become a believer?
Well, for me, it was a pretty short walk from to believer, because I was always fascinated in the topic. A big event for me was in 1973. I was 13 years old at the time, and there was an alleged alien abduction that took place in Pascagoula, Mississippi. Two men were fishing on a pier in the middle of the night, and they were basically kidnapped by these strange robotic beings and floated aboard a UFO and examined and then deposited back out on the pier where they had been fishing. This case just became instantly world famous. It was in the news constantly. And for me, a 13-year-old kid, my only exposure to UFO stories up to this point had been what I read in books from the library. And now suddenly there's this UFO event, spectacular event, that is being reported on in the news. You're hearing it on the radio. I'm seeing it on the TV news. I'm seeing it in the newspaper. So for me, that was the moment at which the UFO phenomenon really became real for me. And at that point, there was absolutely no turning back. And I still find that case one of the most fascinating and puzzling cases in history.
Wow. Well, it's we just have a few minutes remaining with you, unfortunately. But give us something that's happened recently that further cements your belief.
Ooh. Well, there hasn't been anything just within the most immediate time frame, but I can tell you this. I've spent a couple years volunteering for the Mutual UFO Network as a UFO field investigator, and over the last couple years, I've heard some amazing stories from people who I consider to be pretty reliable witnesses of some events that they experienced, but they weren't modern occurrences. In the two cases I'm thinking of, these were people who, after keeping their experience a secret for 10 or 20 or even 30 years, decided that they had to get it off their chest, and they reported it to MUFON online, and then the cases were assigned to me. So I had the privilege of talking to these two people. Two cases in particular. I don't think we have time to go into them unless you can tell me otherwise, but very, very fascinating stories that I simply cannot explain. And as I said, the witnesses in these two cases are, to me, exceptionally credible. I've spent a lot of time talking with both of these people and have never detected the faintest shred of any kind of artifice or dishonesty.
Mark O'Connell, who is a award-winning writer for Star Trek Next Generation series, has written a book, The Close Encounters Man, How One Man Made the World Believe in UFOs. Thanks so much for joining us this morning.
Thanks, Mark.
Thank you for having me. I've enjoyed it.
Yeah, we have too. Okay. When we return, we're going to have a conversation with Mary Roach, who has written Grunt, The Curious Science of Humans at War. You're listening to Cool Science Radio. Stay with us.
This is Earl Foote, founder of Nexus IT, a proud sponsor of Cool Science Radio on KPCW. Nexus IT provides comprehensive cybersecurity solutions to help protect your business from hackers and today's internet-borne security threats. More information at nexusitc.net or at 435-487-9099.
Hi, I'm Courtney Johansson, owner of 350 Main Brasserie. We are pleased to support KPCW. 350 Main is located in the historic Golden Rule Building at 350 Main Street and serves contemporary American cuisine. We are open nightly at 5:30 p.m. Reservations, menu, and contact information at 350main.com.
Hi, this is Dr. Juliana Miller from Miller Orthodontics, a proud supporter of The Local View with Randy Barton. With a combined 45 years of orthodontic experience, my husband and I are now raising our family and working full-time in the Park City community. There are so many reasons to smile in Park City. More information at m2ortho.com.
And welcome back to Cool Science Radio. John Wells here with Lynn Ware Peak. Well, there's lots of apps out there, and here's a new one. It's an app to soothe the packing-averse traveler. So packing anxiety has inspired dozens of apps and services in the last few years, many of them thriving on users' willingness to download checklists to avoid forgetting their socks or their phone chargers. But there's a growing number of other services that have gotten even more personal, inviting themselves into users' calendars and closets. At least one offers a concierge service that does all the packing and then delivers the suitcases to the hotel. There's no need to hoist suitcases onto airport conveyor belts or get stressed out about any of the other annoyances of modern air travel. Lynn, what do you think of that?
I think it sounds like if you don't like to pack, then you probably don't like to download an app either. I mean, isn't it just procrastination or was it? Is there really a packing phobia? I don't get this. I don't like to pack, but it's just because I don't like to take the time.
Yeah, I you know.
So I don't like to take the time to download and figure out an app either.
You know, people just want all sorts of other people to do stuff for them all the time.
You know, that back, I don't know, even as recent as, say, 5 years ago, didn't you always, you came up with this great idea and you say, oh, there should be an app for that.
Yeah.
And you'd think, well, I'm going to develop that app. And then you'd find out that the apps actually existed for, you know, a year already. Well, it's beyond anything that you could imagine a useful app being.
Right.
Now, anything you can imagine that wouldn't even be useful is already an app.
Well, you know, I pack light. I used to travel all the time with my business, so I always packed really light. And I continue to do that today because my back, I've got a bad back. But my fiancée, she packs this thing called the Widowmaker. That's what I call it. And, God, it's awfully heavy. It's too heavy.
The Widowmaker.
It's too heavy.
It's a bad thing to talk about before marriage.
Yeah.
Fiance.
Yeah.
All right. Let's welcome our next guest is Mary Roach. She's written a book called Grunt. Yes, there's a book called Grunt. It's The Curious Science of Humans at War. Roach introduces us to a range of quirky but essential scientific endeavors. With her characteristic sense of humor, enthusiasm, and sharp eye for telling detail, Roach, as always, proves to be the ideal tour guide. Grunt celebrates the courage of people like Navy flight surgeon Angus Rupert, who flew blindfolded and upside down to test a vibrating suit designed to help pilots fly by feel should they become blinded or disoriented, and Captain Herschel Flowers of the Army Medical Research Laboratory, who injected himself with cobra venom to test the possibility of building immunity. Mary Roach, welcome back to Cool Science. Oh, no, we don't have her. Well, we'll wait for her to get back on the air. Let's see. And Mary Roach, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Oh, thanks.
We're glad
happy
to have
to
you
here.
Back. We've talked to you a few times before, your various very entertaining books. And I guess I just have to ask you, you know, you seem to think about aspects of science, in this case, military science, that no one really ever ponders. Why is that? What is it about you? I just love it.
I guess I'm kind of the bottom feeder of nonfiction and science writing. I think I like to go for the things that haven't been written about very much. So I think I just gravitate to those things because I think they'll be fresh for people. And also, I guess it's just something about my twisted sense of curiosity that those are the things that fascinate me.
Right. So within military science, I mean, what you talk about in your book, Grunt, is, again, something that most of us don't think about. What was the first thing that attracted you? What was the first study or the first, product that you found out about that sort of led you down this rabbit hole, shall we say?
It was leech repellent. I was in India. Yeah, I was in reporting a story on the world's hottest chili pepper and this crazy chili pepper eating contest in Northeast India. And because this pepper had been weaponized by the Indian Defense Ministry, I was over at this lab reporting on that. And then while I was there, there was a group that were developing and testing. They were out in the rivers rolling up their trousers and testing various compounds as leech repellents. And that was the moment where I thought, wow, military science, it's a little more esoteric than you might think. It's not just bullets and bombs and strategy. And, you know, I'm not really attracted to death and maiming. I liked the kind of the other side of it, the things that maybe make being a soldier a little more bearable, because it is quite an unpleasant ordeal.
Yeah. Mary, welcome to the program. This is John Wells, and I remember from our earlier conversation on Gulp, An Adventure Down the Alimentary Canal, I just got a kick out of this. You actually had a chapter on flatulence, and I thought, I've never read an author that had a chapter on flatulence, so that's what grabbed my attention.
No, there were three chapters on flatulence.
Oh, there were three chapters. Well, I'm going to go back and read that book then.
Yeah, there was one on the history of how did they study it. There was one on the explosive nature of it, and there was one on probably the smell. In fact, I'm blanking now on what the third one
was. Oh, it was the scientists that sit around in a room and measure and smell them all day.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
that's a heck of a job, huh?
Yeah. It was, how they, right, they in order to participate in a study at this place, you had to prove that you were a producer. That was the term they had. So they fed me a lot of beans, and in fact, I was a producer.
Oh boy!
And I think my husband is an executive producer.
So, and I also wanted to mention that, being from Massachusetts, I am certainly aware of the Natick Labs on Lake Kakichwet, and my sister works in the department that tests all the different food rations for our Army personnel. But you spend a good bit of time in the beginning of the book talking about everything that they do there for clothing and for insect repellent and everything else. Tell us about Natick Labs.
Natick Labs is for someone like me, it's just a geek's holiday. You know, so there's a giant climate chamber where they can test. Maybe it's outerwear, maybe it's all manner of things. They can put it in any kind of weather environment they want. They can have it rain. They can have it be blistering hot. They can have snow. They can create all the humidity they want, and they can just a sleeping bag or something that you're wearing. So that's sort of was the show place piece of the lab when it was opened, was the Dorio climatic chamber. There's that. There's a fashion studio where there's a couple of, or more than a couple of, pedigreed fashion designers who are designing uniform pieces. And not just to make it look slick and cool, but to really take into account what is the person who will wear this piece of clothing, what are they going to do? For example, if they're a sniper, this is a person who will be lying on their front for long periods of time. So you wouldn't want a zipper or buttons right down the front of the top, because that would be uncomfortable. So that, you know, the piece that I saw, it had a side opening instead, and the designer had moved the pockets from the chest to the upper arms so that you're not lying on the pockets. So all of these considerations, and not using Velcro, because that's very loud when you open up, say, a Velcro vest, that makes a loud noise that somebody, you know, could give away your position. So you have to, these fashion designers, some of them had come from, one of them was from Priscilla's of Boston, which was the purveyor of high-end wedding gowns, and another one had made swimwear before that.
Wow.
And then they, yeah.
And why are they making that crossover? I mean, is it just profitable if you're a designer and you're not selling your wedding gowns? Is it more profitable, or do you end up gaining some clout in the industry? Because it would seem to me that if you are developing for military science, I mean, some of these things are developed because of funding, for example, are really developed for the first time and go on to a mass market.
Yes, that's right. Well, in the case of the woman who had, well, both of these women, the wedding gown designer and the swimsuit designer, I asked them, I said, that's kind of a strange move, isn't it, from A to B? And she said, one of them said, actually, when you think about it, a bathing suit is a garment with specialty fabric that is used for a very specific physical activity. So the fabric has to fit the movement of the body. It has to work well in water. So it's a similar awareness of what is the function of the person who's going to wear this, and what sort of fabric can we use. So there's a certain amount of technology that goes into a swimsuit and a wedding gown. Similarly, these are really specialty fabrics and a lot of layering. You think of a fancy wedding gown with a big kind of poofy bottom part. There's many different layers. It has to all, yeah. Right, exactly.
Yeah.
So it's sort of similar to designing a Chembio suit, which has got the activated charcoal layer and the outer protective fabric, the super shedding fabric. So there were some interesting overlaps in the two, surprisingly enough.
Absolutely. Well, now when we go to REI, say, and buy a backpack, you know, very often there are little pockets on the front so that we can, you know, keep our energy bar in the pockets in the front. And I would imagine that, I mean, as you did research for this book, what did you find that surprised you that you found that was developed through military science that we use regularly now? And I've just been sitting here thinking things like Gore-Tex and mesh,
yeah,
under your armpits and things like that.
Yeah, exactly. Gore-Tex is a great example. And permethrin, which is a repellent that can be sort of built into a fabric. You know, it's a treatment that stays on and resists washing over X number of laundry loads. And that is that's something developed by the military. So those are two examples. And when you think about camping, backpacking in particular, the soldiers were the original backpackers. So inflatable rafts, river rafts, and tents. And tents that resist mildew in particular, yeah, those things are developed, not necessarily always invented, but developed for the military. And because there was suddenly a need to be dry and warm and fed, et cetera, in these very remote places, you know, jeeps, you know, those are, you know, all of these things to get around in difficult terrain were all things developed for soldiers.
We get so much help from nature itself, and there's a super repellent cloth that takes its inspiration from lily pads, as they put lily pads under the microscope and see how those pads are structured. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, that's right. There's a super shedding fabric where you drop water on it, not just water, but things that are hard to repel, like alcohols or aviation fuel. You drop it on there and it just rolls right off. It doesn't sink in. And this is important, not just for keeping something clean, but if there's any kind of a chemical weapons attack, you want something that will shed, it will just come right off and that won't penetrate the fabric and get to the body underneath. So yeah, the lily pad, that was fascinating. If you look at a microscopic image of a lily pad, it's got these little kind of micro peaks on it that it just, it's almost like you're, it's almost like a bed of nails for the substance that comes on it. It just doesn't, and there's lots of other things going on with that fabric, but it doesn't penetrate. It's just touching tiny amounts of the surface rather than spreading out and really soaking in. So the lily pad, and not only the lily pad, but it was actually at Natick Labs for a while, a spider room, because spider silk is particularly strong. It's got a really impressive strength to weight ratio. So in other words, it's very lightweight and comfortable, but also very strong. And so that Natick was trying to sort of decode the protein to create a synthetic spider silk, because you can't, it's not like silkworms where you can harvest the silk. Spider spin webs, you can't quite get them to do it on demand. So there was an effort to kind of create a synthetic silk.
And oh, boy.
Silk is used. Silk underwear is popular in the military because it is so strong and light. Like, you wouldn't want Kevlar underwear because they'd be thick and uncomfortable. But the silk, it doesn't break. It doesn't fragment. So if somebody, a bomb goes off close by, and you have a lot of debris that's been accelerated by the explosion, the sand and the dirt that may have bacteria, the silk underwear, which would keep that from penetrating, and it also it doesn't break off little bits, so the little bits of like cotton, for example, would get into the wound and create more infection. So that's, there's nature yet again.
Well, Mary, while we're on the subject of underwear, if I wear red underwear, will I get superpowers?
Well, there was a belief for a while, the color red was thought to be beneficial in hot weather, and I think this came originally out of British troops in India. I'm not remembering exactly where it originated, but the U.S. military heard about it, and it was just, I found this paper on the efficacy of reddish-orange underwear in reducing the effects of extreme heat in the person who wears it. Unfortunately, there were a lot of problems with the study. The underwear was made of kind of a thick dungaree cotton, very uncomfortable in the heat. It was tested in the Philippines.
Well, that's not comfortable in India.
No, but the U.S. version, they had them made. They may have done them in India out of lovely, lightweight cotton, but here they were done very heavy. And the dye wasn't fast. It didn't hold, so it was, and they made caps as well. And the caps, when the men would sweat or when it was raining, the dye would kind of run down their faces, and the stuff faded and it became very dirty looking, and everybody hated it. So I cannot recommend the powers of reddish orange.
I mean, the U.S. Surgeon General got a hold of this when he was told that it had occult medical value. I don't even know what that is, but it sounds pretty cool.
If you look up in the medical journals of the day, you would find recommendations for the color red as being. But it was never really, because I looked at a couple of these papers and the mechanism was never explained. Is it because red, it's not reflective? Like, white would be a better reflective color for a cap, a light color. I have no idea how that actually got started. But the someone in the U.S. military took it seriously enough to have thousands of pairs of underwear. They were also too small. They showed up at the base, and they fit very few of the men.
That's good. Well, since we're talking about underwear, I guess I'll go in this direction. When we travel, especially to foreign countries, especially, sort of in the lower latitude, shall we say, it's often that we develop, what do they call it in Mexico, Montezuma's Revenge or something like that, traveler's diarrhea. And this is a whole chapter in your book. Tell us what kind of science is behind how to control diarrhea for these travelers. I mean, military service will end you up in some strange places.
Yes, absolutely. And historically, diarrhea and dysentery, which is an extreme form of diarrhea where you have bleeding as well, that was responsible for far more deaths of soldiers than combat wounds, sometimes the ratio being like 4-1. And what would happen, this was in the 1800s, before there was a knowledge of how germs got spread and food safety, you'd be in a situation where you have a big camp, say out in a battlefield. You've got dead bodies and garbage in an open pit latrine, tons of flies coming in. The flies would land on the latrine material and then buzz over to the mess tent, and they weren't screened often. And so the flies would just land with this load on their feet of bacteria from the latrine, land and inoculate the food with typhus or yellow fever, whatever they're carrying on their little hairy legs. And now it sits in the sun because of no refrigeration. So you've got this big pot of beans that, you know, 3-4 hours later, you've got a tremendous amount of harmful bacteria. And now you've got hundreds of men sick with diarrhea. Now they're going to the latrine and adding more of that pathogen. And so it spreads through the whole camp, and the whole unit is sick. And often back then, you know, dying because they weren't as good at rehydrating and treating diarrhea as they are now. So it was really it was quite a killer, to the point where in World War II, they were fly control units. Their job was controlling flies. They would sometimes have a death quota. Every soldier had to kill 50 flies. You could see posters that would show a big fly and somebody stabbing it with a bayonet. This is World War II I'm talking about. And it would say, "This is the enemy." And it really was. It really was. The fly killing amazing numbers of soldiers.
Wow. And so in the diarrhea clinical trial, what have they...
Yeah.
What has, you know, what's the product that comes out to control this really huge problem?
Well, I spent some time with Captain Mark Riddle, who is a diarrhea researcher, and he was testing a couple of different drugs. They would be antibiotic regimens that would take effect a lot more quickly. In other words, you could just take one dose and you'd be better, and you'd be back on your feet in a day rather than 3 or 4 days, which would also, the less, you know, a shorter duration of taking antibiotics, not as much time for resistant bacteria to develop. That is the hope. So there were a number of different drugs that were tested. Rifaximin was one. They're more expensive than your garden variety antibiotic, but they're more effective. Anyway, he was testing. It was interesting because he was testing them. I went with him to Camp Lemonnier in Djibouti in North Africa, where a lot of the special operations forces leave on missions from there. And those guys get hit at a rate twice as high as the average soldier because they're eating in little small villages with elders trying to, you know, get information and do the things that they do. They may be eating unrefrigerated food and water that hasn't been treated or filtered, and they get quite sick. And you can imagine if your mission is to go take out Osama bin Laden or whatever you've been sent to do. It's a pretty dire thing, and you can't really step aside and go behind a rock. And often there aren't very many rocks. There's nowhere to go. But it's, as one guy said, kind of a life or death situation, and you just have to keep going. So it's very uncomfortable and unpleasant for them, and you know, it's distracting. So diarrhea could, in a sense, be a matter of national security.
If you're just joining us, we're having a conversation with Mary Roach, who has written Grunt, The Curious Science of Humans at War. Mary, there was a piece in your book which grabbed my attention. It was on transfusions of blood from dead people to alive. Was that something that was popular at some time? Can you talk about that? I mean, I never hear about that, and never heard about it until I read it in your book.
Yeah, no, it was just, it was something that, it was a Norman Bethune was the individual who was practicing it. It was very popular, and it was done in the Soviet Union, not in war, but as a practice that seemed to make sense. That if you could, they had done research figuring out how long is blood viable, you know, after someone dies. So if you were to drain the blood right after the person dies, and there's a window within which the blood remains useful and intact and not decomposed, you could actually use that blood, and the feeling was the waste not to. So there were these clinics or sections of hospitals where for a period, and I don't know how long. I mean, I didn't do a whole chapter on this. It was just a couple of papers, but there was a there was an effort to try that, because if you think about the blood supply on the battlefield, blood is perishable, and there's no refrigerator close by on the battlefield when somebody needs it. So before the medevac units and helicopters were able to arrive so quickly on the scene, that was a logical, if somewhat grisly, alternative. The problem is getting it out of the person who has died, and also getting it into the other person quickly enough, and typing it, making sure it's the right type. Mm-hmm. But in a life or death situation, you know, you would maybe take that chance. I don't think it was done. It wasn't done in any widespread manner. Right. But there were a couple of papers saying this is something we should try.
And, well, once again, it's an example of something that needs to be done the first time. Someone has to volunteer for that. So that's fascinating. Mary, I wanted to ask you, you know, your books are always very well researched. What about this book has surprised, or this topic has surprised you the most as you've done your research?
Oh gosh, it was all a surprise. I mean, I everywhere I turned, I had no idea there was such a profession as military entomologist. I had no idea that the maggot was useful as a natural form of debridement, that you would intentionally put maggots into a wound to clean out the dead tissue and fight infection.
Right.
That seemed counterintuitive to me, and the fact that it's still done today. Mm-hmm. Maggots are used, particularly with diabetics who have some, like, ulcerations that are very difficult to clear up. That was tremendously surprising. The chicken gun, never heard of that. The fact that you would need to test, I mean, it makes perfect sense to test, say, the canopy of a jet to make sure that if a mallard duck or a Canada goose hits it, it's not going to shatter and hit the pilot or compromise the flight. So chicken gun is something that fires the defrosted supermarket chickens at these jet pieces to make sure they can withstand bird strike. Again, makes sense, but the whole existence of a chicken gun, all this research that went into, should we use a chicken? The chicken doesn't really fly. It's not shaped like a duck. Maybe we should go fly or like capture ducks in the wild. Maybe we should make an artificial duck. You know, there's all these papers looking into what's the best way to do this. What should we really be firing out of this large piece of artillery?
That is so great. And also, it's the chicken gun has a 60-foot barrel and expels the birds at 400 miles an hour. I mean, that makes sense, because if you're flying in a plane, you're going 400 miles an hour. The 60-foot barrel, that's got to be about the most fun test experiment, I would say, in this whole operation.
Yeah, it's a heavy artillery piece, the chicken gun. It's quite spectacular. But
Well, Mary Roach, what a pleasure to hear from you again. And you are quite prolific. I mean, I think the last time we spoke with you was maybe just a little over a year ago. You just have a whole repertoire here. And what's your next work?
Oh, well, I it's lovely to hear that, but I'm not prolific. I think it's good. This is a book about, this is about 3 years, this book for the
time flies
and writing. But next up, I don't know. I just backed out of a project. I'm a woman without a book. I'm open to suggestions.
Oh, my. Okay. Well, we'll put a challenge out there to our listeners then. The book is Grunt, The Curious Science of Humans at War. Mary Roach is our guest. And thank you so much, Mary, for joining us again on Cool Science Radio.
Oh, thanks so much for having me. I always enjoy it.
All right. Bye-bye. And we'll be back after these words.
This is Larry Warren, and as I prepare to leave leadership of KPCW in Renee Bodley's very capable hands, I want to thank you, who are both our listeners and owners. KPCW is the heartbeat of our great Wasatch Back communities, from Summit Park to Heber City and worldwide online. Please always remember that nonprofit community radio is only as strong as the support it receives. Thanks for your past support, and let's make it even stronger as Renee takes KPCW into the future.
Spend the day and cover billions of years at the Natural History Museum of Utah. The museum offers innovative exhibits and hands-on experiences. Native voices explore the traditions of Utah's native peoples. The Great Salt Lake Gallery tells the story of the largest saltwater lake in the Western Hemisphere. The Past Worlds exhibit includes more than a dozen new species of dinosaurs discovered right here in Utah. Visit nhmu.utah.edu. The Natural History Museum of Utah is a nonprofit organization and a KPCW supporter.
Thanks for tuning in to Cool Science Radio. I want to thank our guest today, Mark O'Connell. He wrote the book The Close Encounters Man, How One Man Made the World Believe in UFOs. And also Mary Roach. She wrote the book about the curious science of humans at war. It's Grunt. Also want to thank our underwriters, San Francisco Design, Berkshire Hathaway Home Services, Utah Properties, Peak Art and Frame, Nexus IT, the Natural History Museum of Utah, and Park City Mountain. And a few more words from our underwriters. You're listening to KPCW Park City.
Additional funding for programming on KPCW has been provided in part by AMA Waterways and Park City Air, Cruise, and Travel, 565-4730, parkcityaircruiseandtravel.com. Long, Reimer, Weiniger, Bepler, Estate Planning, Family Law, lrw-law.com. And the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and listeners like you.
It's KPCW Park City,